back in Brazil, and partially with Andrew Childs here at IQC in a visit I did 6 months last year. We talk about match gates and XY interaction and arbitrary graphs. So just to motivate, imagine we know how to build a fully fault-tolerant universal quantum computer, right? But maybe we don't. There are some parts, some specific parts of it that are harder to implement, or maybe there are some things that are a little more noisy. So we want to study restricted subsets, all right, restricted models of quantum computation. So, you know, because maybe we have like this all-powerful computer, but then we find out that there are some parts of it that we can remove, that but we still get, you know, pretty much the same thing. And maybe, you know, if we remove something else, we're not exactly sure what we can do. We can still do some interesting things, but we're not completely sure. And, you know, eventually you've just imposed so many restrictions that you have nothing, have a paperweight, right? So my personal interest here is in studying these restricted models of quantum computation for two main reasons. The first kind of reasons, more fundamental reasons, right, to understand what are the resources that are at the heart of the quantum computation speedup, and, you know, understand how this computational power changes as we change the underlying interactions a little bit, and underlying restrictions, sorry, a little bit. But there are also some, you know, more technological experimental reasons for studying these restricted models. So, you know, maybe we want to know whether we can perform quantum computation with those tools that are natural to a specific physical system, right? So usually quantum computation, the circuit model, you phrase it as, you know, you can do universal set of 2-qubit gates and 1-qubit gate, and this allows you to implement any unitary. But maybe you have a restricted set of unitaries that's proper to the physical system that you have. So you want to know whether that's universal or not. And also, maybe we want to obtain some intermediate milestones for the field. So maybe we want to find some device that's not universal for quantum computation, but maybe it can perform some task that is supposed to be classically hard, and it's easier to implement like in the nearby future before we have a fully powerful quantum computer. So, you know, there are several types of systems where this kind of thing has been studied. So the different kind of restrictions that you can apply, for example, maybe you want to restrict, you have a universal quantum circuit, universal set of quantum gates, but you want to restrict that amount of time or space that it has, right? Or no, or, you know, maybe you want to restrict the types of operations that you have. So maybe you only have Clifford gates, and you know that if you're acting with these Clifford gates only on computational basis inputs, you have something which has no non-trivial computational power beyond classical computers. But then, you know, you add match gates and classical adaptation of measurements, then you get universal quantum computation. And, you know, there are other kinds of more different physical constraints that you can impose. So, you know, you could study what happens if you have a limited amount of entanglement at any point during your computation. Or, you know, if you have, for example, linear optics, because we know that if you have linear optics by result by Neil Laflamme and Milburn, we know that if you have linear optics with measurement adaptation, right? So you perform a measurement and you change what you do after that depending on the measurement outcome. You know that that's universal for quantum computation. But, you know, if you don't have adaptive measurements, then there's also this recent proposed model of boson sampling, which, you know, is just based on sort of watching the photons in their natural habitat. And this gives a kind of computational task that maybe if it's not useful for anything, it's still something that you expect to be hard to do on a classical computer. But this is not what I'm interested in this. I worked in this a little bit, but not what I'm going to talk about today. Specifically, what I'm going to talk is about a curious set of 2-qubit gates where this change in computational power happens when you change the connectivity restrictions, right? So these match gates, I'm going to define precisely what everything is, don't worry. But these match gates, it is known that if you have your qubits arranged on a path and these match gates can act only between nearest neighbors, this can be simulated classically. But And you know, this is equivalent to fermionic linear optics, which is a curious contrast with usual bosonic linear optics. But if you have these match gates and you can implement them between first and second neighbors, then you get universal quantum computation. So it seems that there's a very small change in the underlying connectivity restrictions that's taking your computational power all the way up to quantum computation, right? And this is the kind of thing that I'm going to be interested in here. So the outline of what I'm going to talk, I'm going to give a brief introduction and, you know, brief review of what was known for match gates before this. And then I'm going to talk about match gates acting on arbitrary graphs. So specifically what I mean is that, you know, previously I mentioned that if you have match gates acting on nearest neighbors, then you get something which is classically simulatable. But this assumes that your qubits are all arranged in a path, arranged in a 1D lattice, for example, right? So here we're going to consider what happens if we change the underlying graph. So if your qubits are arranged in a different graph, and they, you can do more than just act in a path. And then what I'm going to do two brief examples that sort of build up the tools and the intuition for the rest. And then I'm going to give our main result. And if there is time and interest at the end, I'm not going to talk about this too much, about a specific case which is still classically simulatable. But if there is interest, I have some slides prepared at the end. And then I'm going to talk about the XY interaction, show how the same kind of result hold for the XY interaction. Okay, so first an introduction about match gates. If you don't know what match gates are, don't worry, I'm going to define it shortly. But for now, just know that match gates were a restricted set of two-qubit gates that were defined by Valiant in 2001, actually, I think this is wrong. And, you know, as I mentioned, we know that they are classically simulatable when they are acting on first neighbors. And in this regime, they are equivalent to systems of non-interacting fermions. If they can act on first and second neighbors, you get universal quantum computation. And, you know, I already did the work with Ernesto Galvão back in 2011, where he showed that, you know, there is a large family of gates that you can add to this set to get universal quantum computation. So if the change in the restriction that you're making is adding new gates, then almost everything that you can do ends up giving you universal computation. Okay? And the XY interaction is a proper subset of match gates, all right, that was already studied before. And it has the same, I mean, it had the same computational regimes were already known. So it was also known that on first neighbors it was classically simulatable, but then on first and second neighbors it was known that it was universal. And here I'm going to show that everything that I say for match gate is also going to be true for the XY interaction. And this is actually interesting because the XY interaction arises much more naturally in actual implementations of, in actual physical systems, actual implementations of quantum computation. It's much more natural than the whole set of match gates. So, you know, as I mentioned before, the usual assumptions in the circuit model, I guess, you usually assume that your qubits are arranged on a path simply because there's no loss of generality in not considering this in general. You know, usually you either have a certain physical system where your qubits are flying, for example, photons, so you can swap your qubits around very easily. So you can just assume that they're aligned on a path, and if you need to interact this guy with this guy, you just swap them around and then swap them back. Or maybe, you know, if you have the standard, one of the standard universal sets, if you have, for instance, the C0 gate, then you can create a swap gate out of the C0 gates, and again, this connectivity restriction doesn't really matter. You can assume that they're aligned in a path, right? But as I mentioned, for match gates, this is different. We know that the power of match gates changes if we change sort of which qubits can interact with each other. So here I'm going to talk, you know, I'm going to align, consider qubits aligned on completely different graphs. So maybe you have one qubit that can sort of interact with all the others and they can't interact between themselves. Or for instance, you say a complete binary tree, or you know, whatever you can imagine, whatever graph you can imagine, you can ask whether, you know, if you act with match gates along the edges of this graph, do you get universal quantum computation or not? Okay. And if I'm talking, you know, too fast or too soft, just let me know. Okay, so what is a match gate? A match gate is a two-qubit gate, all right, that has this form with the extra restriction that the determinant of this A guy here outside is equal to the determinant of this B guy here inside. These determinants don't need to be one because you can put just an global phase on this overall gate, but they have to be the same, right? This defines a two-qubit match gate. And you know, you could think about the swap gate because the only reason why the swap gate is not match gate is the determinant condition, because the swap, okay, so maybe it's easier if I do it like this. So the swap gate just has a one here, a one here on this B21, a one here, and then one here. So you know, it has this form, but the determinant of the part on the inside is x, is minus 1, and it's not equal to the other one, right? So the swap gate is not a match gate. So this restriction on connectivity that I was talking about is relevant. Okay? Okay, so just to illustrate what you have, imagine that you have a circuit, and you input all qubits in the zero state, or, you know, this actually can be any product state. And then you just apply your match gates on nearest neighbors, and then you measure one qubit at the end. Okay? If you only apply match gates between nearest neighbors, you can simulate, you can compute the probability of observing a zero or a one on this qubit. But then if you just allow, if you just take this little difference that now you can act between, so this is not a three-qubit gate, okay? This is a two-qubit gate acting between like the first and this last one, sorry. But if you allow to interact between qubits that are like one line apart, so they're like second neighbors, then you already get universal quantum computation. So the immediate consequence of that is that my original question is partly already answered, okay? Because notice that if you have first and second neighbors for qubits arranged on a path, this is equivalent to having first neighbors for qubits arranged on this graph here, right? Simply because, for example, 3 can interact with 1 and 2 and 4 and 5, and here 3 can interact with 1 and 2 and 4 and 5, okay? So, I mean, it's already known before this work that, you know, this graph, for example, is universal for quantum computation with match gates, right? So, you know, what about other graphs? Why can we, you know, give a set of necessary or sufficient conditions for it to be able to do universal quantum computation on a given graph? Okay. So I'm going to explain in more detail two examples, and then you know that you're going to see that the main result is going to follow very straightforwardly from these two examples. Okay. So the first example I'm going to consider is this graph. So you have a path of n minus one vertices, and you just append one extra vertex almost anywhere. It just cannot be at the endpoint because that's just a longer path, right? But if you put this extra vertex here anywhere except at the endpoints, that's okay. So one thing that's important to mention is that we're going to need to use some notion of encoded universality. Because, you know, these match gates, so if I just go back here, so the first thing that you notice is that they're parity preserving. They don't change the parity of the qubits. So you're never going to be able to start with, say, an even parity string and end up with an odd parity string. But, you know, that's okay. We're going to encode our logical qubits as two physical qubits, and then we're going to show that you can do universal computation on these logical qubits. Okay. So the first thing, the first step to show that is start with this match gate here, which is known as the fermionic swap, okay? And you can check the determinant condition. It's determinant's minus one for this little 2x2 matrix on the outside, and it's minus one this guy here on the inside too, right? And this is the fermionic swap simply because if you interpret a qubit being 0, 1 as a fermionic mode that can be empty or occupied, then you know it's it puts a minus sign on the 1-1 state. So if both modes are occupied, then you just swap the two fermions, then you get a minus one sign. Okay. And you know, even though it looks like the swap, except for this minus sign here, it's immediate that it cannot replace the swap in the most general case. You cannot use it to simulate the swap in the most general case, right? Two reasons. You can see that. The first one is that, you know, while the swap isn't a match gate, this guy is. So, you know, if you could use it to simulate the swap at any time, then you would have universal quantum computation with match gates on a path, simply because you could, you know, wherever you have the swap, you could use this guy instead. So this is obviously cannot be possible. And also because, you know, while the swap does not entangle the qubits, this guy is maximally entangling. It's just the swap times the CZ, so it's maximally entangling. So, you know, it obviously cannot replace the swap in general. But there are three useful facts that you can say about this guy. Three situations where it does look a little bit like the swap, right? So the first thing, you know, if you have this fermionic swap acting on two qubits, but one of these qubits is in the zero state, then it is exactly like the swap, simply because you're never going to get a minus one because you're never going to get the 1-1 state. So if one of the qubits is in the zero state, this is exactly like the swap. And we're going to use this because we're going to consider that graph I showed previously, and we're going to initialize some of the qubits in that graph in the zero state, and we're going to kind of use this identity to move them around and to maneuver the other qubits. Okay? And the second identity, which is going to be useful, is that if one of these qubits is in the logical state, okay, so it is actually two qubits here, so this is going to be this sort of shorthand for like alpha 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, then you can also use the fermionic swap to swap the two guys. Because, you know, this phi here, it's either it's going to be in the 0, 0 state, and then you're not going to get the minus ones, or it's going to be in the 1, 1 state, and you're going to get the minus sign twice. Right? So the fermionic swap, it behaves exactly like the swap if you're swapping logical qubits at a time. Okay? And the third thing that's going to be interesting is just noticing that the fermionic swap is a control Z times the swap. Right? So, you know, what this is going to be useful for is that I'm going to show that we're going to use these two identities to simulate a swap operation around that extra vertex. And then we're going to use this identity to get a CZ between the two gates, between the two qubits, sorry. And this is going to give the thing that's missing for universal quantum computation. I'm going to explain that in a little detail now. So, okay, so say you want to do a universal quantum circuit, what do you do? Well, okay, the first thing that you do, you're going to encode your logical qubits 0 as 0, 0, and 1 as 1, 1. Okay? The next thing that you note is that any logical single qubit gate is simply implemented by a match gate. And the reason why this is true is that, you know, match gates can arbitrarily mix the 0, 0, and the 1, 1 state. Okay? So here. So if they can arbitrarily mix the 0, 0, and 1, 1 state, then, you know, this gives arbitrary single qubit states. Okay? And now I'm going to explain how we can do a logical CZ gate, because, you know, if you have arbitrary single qubit gates, then if you have a CZ gate, which is entangling, then you're good. That's going to be a universal set. Okay? So what you do is first you notice that in order to implement a logical CZ gate, all you need to do is implement a physical CZ gate between one qubit of each pair, right? So if these two guys encode one logical qubit and these two guys encode one logical qubit, if this guy is in the one state, then both of its small qubits are going to be in the one state. So it suffices to implement a CZ between, say, 2 and 3, and that is going to put, you know, the overall minus sign exactly where you need it to implement an overall CZ gate. Okay? So what you do the following. You initialize two qubits here in the zero state. Okay? This white circle is going to represent qubits that are in the zero state. Then you're going to use that identity 2 that I showed, that, you know, you can use the fermionic swap to swap logical qubits. So you're going to use this identity to bring the two logical qubits that you want to entangle to this spot right here, right? And you know, this little piece here, it always shows up as a subgraph of that greater graph, that larger graph, okay? And then, you know, you're going to use that identity too to take these two qubits, 3 and 4, and put them in this configuration, right? That's okay too, because you're moving one whole logical qubit at a time. Okay, so if you're in this configuration, what you do is a little shuffling around. So remember that I said that picture this as these white circles, which are still started in the zero state. Picture them, say, as if they were holes, as if they were empty spaces that you can move the other qubits through, right? And you can always do that because it's always going to be left in the zero state moving around if you use the fermionic swap, okay? Because remember that it behaves exactly like the swap. So then you just do this shuffling around here. You just, you know, you want to swap 1 and 3, so you just send 1 over there into where alpha was, and then you're just going to send 3 over here where beta was, and then you're just going to undo that in the reverse order. So you're just going to send 1 back here and 3 back here, and the overall action of that, you know, sequence of operations is that you've just swapped 1 and 3, right? So just, you know, to try to make it more concrete, what I did was I used sort of this extra vertex here to maneuver the qubits around and simulate the action of the swap gate. So I cannot use the swap gate, but I can simulate its action based on the fact that I have this degree 3 vertex here. Okay? And then now, remember that swap times fermionic swap is a CZ. So since I've swapped 1 and 3, I just apply the fermionic swap between 1 and 3, and it's going to leave them in their original state, but with an overall action of a CZ gate. Okay? And, you know, since we can apply single qubit gates, arbitrary, and apply logical CZ gates between any two logical qubits, then we get universal quantum computation. You may worry that there's going to be a certain overhead here on the number of shufflings around that you're going to do, but you can show that this is only a polynomial overhead. Right, so this proves that that graph is universal. So now I'm going to do another example, which is for the complete binary tree. Right? Here, we cannot use the same construction that we used this before, because now the longest path has only logarithmic length. Right? So you cannot put your computational qubits, your logical qubits, on this long path and then shuffle them around 1 degree 3 vertex. But now you can do something else, which is even simpler. Instead of trying to use a long path to do your computation, you're going to do your computation directly on the leaves of the tree. All right? So you use the leaves as computational qubits, and every non-leaf you initialize in the zero state. And now you can interpret these white circles again as sort of empty spaces, and you can just use the fermionic swap to say, take this qubit here, move it around, and bring it near to this qubit here, then apply a match gate between them, and then just move it back. And if you do that, then you can apply match gates between any pairs of qubits, and that, again, is universal because of what was known before. And again, of course, you have to sacrifice half of your qubits, and you have to do a certain logarithmic number of fermionic swaps for everything that you want to do, but that's okay, right? And now this graph, then, is also universal. Now, you know, the mix and match of these two things that I mentioned kind of already gives a straightforward universal construction for a large family of graphs. And I stopped at this point with Ernesto back in Brazil because, I mean, we could show that several of these graphs are universal, but we didn't have like a unifying way to prove that every graph is universal. So this is what I did with Andrew last year when I arrived here. So, you know, it's easy to show based on two examples that, first, any graph that has a suitably long path, where suitable here means, of course, polynomial in the size of the graph. Any graph with a suitably long path and some degree 3 vertex is universal. And any tree with a suitably large number of leaves is also universal, right? So all that's missing, and you know, maybe there's some textbook on graph theory somewhere that has this as an exercise, but I had no idea how to show this, so I came here. And what we managed to show is that there is a trade-off between these two things. So you can always, for every graph, you can always get one of these two things being true, and then you can apply one of those two examples that I showed. So, you know, we proved this lemma that if you have T that's an n-vertex tree, and this tree has L leaves, and the longest path is of length B, then either one of these two things has to be greater than square root of n. And the way you show that is very simple. You start with a tree, and then you choose one leaf, and then you delete every vertex on the tree up to this closest branching point, right? And you know that every time you do that, you've deleted less than p vertices, right? And if you repeat that for every leaf, eventually you have deleted the whole graph. You have deleted all the n vertices of the tree. And you know, if you account this properly, you arrive at something like L times p has to be greater than n. So one of these two things has to be greater than square root of n. Okay? So, you know, now our main result, just kind of straightforward from this. So let G be any n-vertex connected graph. Oh, yes, I forgot to mention this. We are only considering connected graphs, but that's kind of trivial because if the graph is disconnected, then you have like subsets of qubits which can never interact with each other, and that's just like two smaller computers. So we only consider connected graphs. So let G be any n-vertex connected graph other than a path or a cycle. Then using a sequence of patch gates acting on G, it is possible to efficiently simulate any quantum circuit on, you know, order square root of n qubits. And the way that you show this is just by mixing the things that I've mentioned so far. So if G is not a path or a cycle, then it has some spanning tree that is not a path. All right. By lemma one, this tree either has a path of length square root of n, or it has square root of n leaves. If the first is true, use example one. If the second is true, use example two. If both are true, just, you know, do what you want. So if T is universal, then G is universal. Simply because if you have a graph and you know there's a spanning tree that's universal, you can just ignore any extra edges and just do universal quantum computation on that. So, you know, maybe this theorem, it might be a little wasteful in some aspects. So maybe we just throw away too many qubits during the construction, or you know, maybe if we didn't ignore the edges from a general graph, we could get a more efficient construction. But I think this is a neat way to prove that any graph is going to be universal, except of course the path or a cycle. You know, not considering matters of efficiency, it's always going to be a polynomial overhead on the simulation anyway. Okay. So that's our main result. If anyone has any questions now, it's a good time to stop.
So do you know whether this square root n is optimal, or could you maybe, like, would it be possible to get like, you know, two thirds?
So this lemma is tight, okay. Right? But maybe this is probably not optimal, right? But for instance, and there are several situations where we know that it's not optimal. So you can construct on a sort of case-by-case basis, you can construct a better way to do this. But we didn't manage to prove that you could always do that. You could always get a better. And we also didn't get an example that's where this was tight. So I don't know. Anything else? So as I mentioned, you know, this proves that any graph that is not a path or a cycle is universal. And we know that a path is simulatable by previous results. So, you know, what about a cycle? So this is a little too cumbersome to explain. So I'm not going to enter into details of this now, but I do have slides prepared at the end. So if anyone's interested, just ask me. But, you know, we actually managed to show that if you have match gates acting on the cycle, this is also classically simulatable. You can adapt the simulation scheme for the path and show that the same is true for the cycle, right? So, you know, this closes all possibilities. You don't, you know what the computational power of match gates is on any connected graph. Okay? All right, but now, you know, maybe, I mean, I didn't write this down, but so if you look at the underlying interactions for these unitaries, for these match gates, the Hamiltonians that generate the set of match gates are these six, XX, YY, XY, YX, and single qubit Z Hamiltons, okay? So, you know, exponentials of these six guys give you the whole set of match gates. But, you know, as far as I know, this exact set does not arise as a natural set of operations on some physical system. I mean, not that I know of. Either you have subsets of these, or you have more. And, you know, if you have more, you're probably going to get universal computation anyway. And you have, if you have less, maybe, you know, you might worry that what I've proved so far might not be true. So there are specific cases for which we know that this, we know what the answer is going to be. So if you have the subsets known as the XY interaction, all right, so that's just having the XX plus YY Hamiltonian, right? So all that you can apply are unitaries, which are exponentials of IT XX plus YY. All right, or maybe, you know, you have that, but if you also have, say, single qubit Z gates, for example. So I'm going to focus on these two, okay? And, you know, before we did this work, it was known that these guys all had the same computational regime as match gates. All of these guys are simulatable on first neighbors, of course, because they're subsets of match gates. But they are all universal on first and second neighbors. So, you know, you may ask, can we adapt what I've told you so far for the XY interaction? And, you know, just this is just, you know, a warning that none of these physical implementations are, you know, my expertise. I don't know much about this, so if I say something wrong, I'm sorry. But, and, you know, there's this nice paper by Lidar and Wu where they sort of catalog some of these systems, like quantum Hall system and quantum dots, where these interactions do arise naturally. Okay? So, first thing, if you can implement, if you can apply the single qubit Z gates, right, Z rotations, then all I've said so far holds, because the fermionic swap can be built only out of the XY interaction and of single qubit Z gates, Z rotations. Okay? So you know, in this case everything holds. But if you don't have even that, so if you only have the XY interaction, and notice that this is a very limited set of gates. All right, I mean, it's a proper subset of match gates because, I mean, it looks like this, and it doesn't even do anything on the 0, 0, and 1, 1 state. So it's a very limited set of gates, and even here you don't have, like, all liberty. You only have, like, an X rotation here. But, you know, in particular, one gate that's in this set is this which we call the I-swap. Right, so it's just a swap with this extra I phase here, and you can check that this is a match gate simply because the determinant here is going to be plus 1. And, you know, it's just exponential of pi over 4 xx plus yy. So what we can show is that we can use this guy to prove an analogous version of this theorem that I've already showed you, right? So I'm not going to prove in this in very much detail because, you know, it's a little cumbersome, the expressions that you get, but I'm going to highlight the differences that you have to look out for to proving this version of the theorem, all right? And the first one is obvious. Before, we had encoded our logical qubits into 0, 0, and 1, 1. But, you know, this interaction does nothing on 0, 0, and 1, 1. So we cannot do that. So we're going to encode our logical qubits on 0, 1, and 1, 0. Okay? But no, that's OK. It just means that you're going to have to initialize some of the qubits on the 1 state and some on the 0. And now, you know, we have sort of the XY version of the facts that I have mentioned before. So one of the things is this. Remember that for the fermionic swap, if one of the qubits was in the zero state, then it behaved exactly like the swap. Here, if one of the qubits is in the zero state, this does behave like the swap, but it induces a P gate, right? this guy here, it induces a peak gate on the other qubit. Right? So, you know, you're going to have to watch out for this, but we're going to be able to, you know, circumvent this. And the second identity is exactly the same as we had for the fermionic swap. So, you know, if you apply two I-swaps on a complete logical qubit, then you swap them only up to, before, you know, you swap them perfectly, now it's up to a global phase that's irrelevant. So, you know, the I-swap behaves as the swap on logical qubits, the same way that the fermionic swap did. Okay? So, that theorem one, it follows through with just a few differences. The first one is that the set of operations that you had to do, it's less obvious. So before, there was this nice sort of operational approach where you, you know, visualize the zero ancillas as empty spaces and you move the other guys around through these empty spaces. Here, this, you know, it's not so obvious. But, you know, if you take the XY interaction and you conjugate by a weird set of operations here, you get an encoded two-qubit gate that is entangling. So I'm not going to show explicit expressions, but, you know, there is one. And the other things that you have to take care of is that, remember that I said that if some of the qubits is in the zero state, when you move a qubit through a zero state, it may catch a p-gate, an overall p-gate, right? So, you know, if some of your qubits pick up a p-gate through when they move through an odd number of zeros, because if they move through an even number of zeros, these p-gates cancel out, but if they move through an odd number of zeros, you get a p-gate. So if some of your qubits suffer this p-gate, what you do is just separate the set of all your qubits that was in the theorem one into those that do suffer a p-gate and those that don't, and just, you know, choose whichever set is larger. And also, the other thing is that for some graphs, you only obtain real orthogonal matrices rather than general unitary matrices, but that's okay because that's universal too. Okay? And so, you know, in conclusion, I didn't provide explicit details, but you can believe me that the XY interaction is also universal on any graph that is not a path or a cycle, in much the same way as we did for general match gates before. Of course, this result kind of subsumes the previous one because the XY interaction is a subset of match gates, but, you know, the previous one is a little easier to explain, a little more explicit. Okay, so that's it. Pretty much what I wanted to say. What we did, we established this dichotomy, right, that for any n-vertex connected graph, if it is a path or a cycle, the thing is classically simulatable. Otherwise, it becomes universal for quantum computation. And you don't have like a family of graphs where you have some intermediate computational power, for example. That does not happen. Unfortunately, the set of match gates does not arise as the sort of complete set of interactions from a physical system. But, you know, then we show that the same dichotomy holds for the XY interaction, which is, you know, an idealized model of some physical implementations of quantum computing, which people actually do care about. And, you know, one thing which I think is very interesting is that this provides a huge architectural flexibility for these physical implementations. So, you know, maybe you go to the lab and you build like a system of, you know, quantum dots, and they're like arranged in some square lattice, or maybe your square lattice has some faults in it, some missing pieces. Or maybe, you know, one interesting example is this model of ancilla-driven or ancilla-controlled quantum computation, where you have one ancilla that can interact with all your qubits and they cannot interact between themselves. And that's just the equivalent of having a star graph, having one qubit in the middle, which can, you know, interact with all the others, and they can't interact between themselves. So, you know, we believe that this sort of result, you know, can be useful in a wide variety of situations. Right? Finally, just, you know, some open questions that we left. First of all, is that, you know, I've sort of sold this to you, the XY interaction as being the set of interactions that arise naturally in a physical system. But, you know, maybe that's cheating just a little bit because it's also an idealized model. Of course, in physical systems, you're not going to have the perfect interaction as I wrote it. And there are techniques that are known to deal with this problem on if you have batch gates acting on that triangular ladder, so acting between first and second neighbors. Then you know you can deal with these experimental imperfections in that setting. And I don't know whether you can use the same techniques to deal with these imperfections for arbitrary graphs. A second question would be, you know, is there some non-trivial subset of match gates for which this kind of dichotomy does not hold? So one candidate that we thought was maybe, you know, what if you only have DXX Hamiltonian? If you only have DXX Hamiltonian, the computation that you get at the end is a subset of a recently proposed IQP model, where this IQP model basically, you know, you start with all of your qubits in the computational basis, and then you apply only gates which are diagonal in the X basis, and then you measure at the end. And this has some intermediate computational power in the sense that it's something like boson sampling, something that is expected to be hard for a classical computer to do, while still not being universal for quantum computation. So, you know, maybe if you only have the DXX Hamiltonian, it's a match gate, and maybe for some graphs you could do something equivalent. But we didn't think this through too much. Of course, just as Gus asked, can we optimize this theorem to discard less qubits or to use less swapping operations? Maybe can we draw from what is known for distributed quantum computing, you know, where you have ways of optimizing the number of swapping arounds that you do. And finally, we know that nearest neighbor match gates on a path correspond to non-interacting fermions. Can, you know, we use the inverse route for some specific graph, so can we start from some specific graph that we know is universal and try to map it back to fermions and see if this proposes some simplification for fermionic quantum computing, right? So this is what I wanted to say, and you know, as a thank you for the nice weather, I'll leave you with a photo from our university, from the view from our university back in Brazil. So thank you. Any questions? I don't know. I couldn't say. I mean, I know that it does arise naturally for some kind of physical systems, but I couldn't say like if there are fundamental reason why you would expect this to be true. I just but there are some examples that it is, and I don't know of any examples where general match gates universe appear. So that's it. Any other questions?
Bit of clarification here, these match gates are kind of new to me.
Okay,
so, sorry. I mean, you said that they don't necessarily correspond to some, you know, popularly studied physical system. So what was the original motivation for considering these things in the first place? Then?
So originally, they arised, they're defined by valence in some graph theoretical terms that had to do with the problem of finding perfect matchings in a graph. I don't know, I never followed the original paper. All I followed was a paper that came out a little bit afterwards by Terhal and DiVincenzo, where it was shown that this corresponded to non-interacting fermions. So that's where I arrived.
Is this purely classical? Is that correct? The
Valiant
paper?
No. I mean, it was just like, I think it's like quantum computations that can be simulated classically is the name of the paper or something like that. So it was just a way, I think, as a way of finding a certain set of, you know, very complex quantum circuits, you know, that you had no obvious reason to expect that they were classically simulatable, and well, they were. And then, you know, just afterwards, Terhal and DiVincenzo proved that they were equivalent to non-interacting fermions. So, you know, I guess that's where my motivation is a little bit more. Sorry? I didn't understand.
Is the dichotomy in the computation of power such as mesh gates a typical exception?
Okay, sorry. Can you repeat the first part of the question because I didn't get the first words? I'm sorry.
Now, in mesh gates, you have small changes, then you have less than a single level and the universal. You have this coupling.
Mm-hmm.
So, you just have a typical exception.
Oh, I see. Okay. I know there's a lot of situations where this kind of thing does happen, like with Clifford circuits. I think that if you add almost any non-Clifford gate, you just jump straight up from classical simulatable to quantum universe. You don't stop anywhere in between. And there are some situations, and even with match gates, if you add any gate, so let me just go back to the expression. There it is. So even if you have match gates, and they're acting on nearest neighbors, so it's classically simulatable, but if you add any gate where this determinant condition is not satisfied, even by a little bit, right? Add any one gate which does not satisfy this, then you get universal quantum computation all over again. So, you know, it seems like any small thing that you do already gives, like, the full computational power. So these are examples that I know, but I wouldn't know say that typical exception. Any questions?
You had this future direction about going backward from simulations of match gates on certain graphs to sort of understand something about fermions. Could you say something more about that?
Yes. I mean, one example. Yes, exactly. But I mean, for instance, if you have this situation here, right? So, you know, if it's just, say, a path, then it corresponds to non-attracting fermions. But when you add one extra guy here, which is not on the path, right? If you try to describe match gates on this graph, and if you try to map it back to fermions, right? This corresponds to having like a bunch of fermionic modes where two of them can interact. So you have mostly non-interacting fermions, but then two of them can interact. And then, you know, can just bring any two fermions over to that little site which can interact them, then move them back. So, you know, of course, there are some situations like the binary tree or the star graph where the mapping back to fermions just look horrible. I don't know whether there is some specific graph where it might go back and look like something interesting, I guess.
Okay, but turning that in the other way, suppose you have a graph with three fermions, but it's not a line. Do we know that that's classically simulatable?
So you mean sort of fermions that live on the sides of a graph. I think that's classically simulatable if they're not interacting. Yes, I think that's always classically simulatable for any graph. But then again, it does not map to match gates on the corresponding graph, of course.
Further questions? All right, if not, then let's thank Daniel again.